Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, if you're like me, you try your best to stay up on international news, especially when it comes to the Middle East. But one story that's harder and harder to understand has to be that of the conflict in Syria. Once dominating headlines, the conflict has simmered in the news, yet there's no end in sight to a civil war that has claimed the lives of over 500,000 people. It all started as a protest for freedoms against an extremist dictator with a terrible humanitarian record. The protests went from peaceful to violent and from protest to rebellion. And in that mix, a part of the rebellion hijacked by the terrorist group ISIS. So now you have a full-on war involving many parties, and the Syrian people are caught in the middle. Millions have had no choice but to take their families and endure harsh, life-threatening conditions to flee the country or either set up shop in border countries or attempt entry into countries with friendly immigration policies, namely Sweden and Germany, and all the while watching Western media and Western politicians vilify them, calling them dangerous. It's a complicated story, but that story is one that's usually told by the pundits and the media and the politicians using it as a campaign issue. But we rarely hear the story told by those who've experienced it, the Syrian people. Enter Wendy Perlman. The author and political science professor at Northwestern spent years collecting the stories of Syria for her new book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. The book is part history lesson, part present-day nightmare, and a look at the future of Syria that seems bleaker and bleaker by the day. Wendy Perlman, my guest tonight at the big table. Ms. Perlman, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, I love this book. This is great to be able to hear from the people that are actually affected by this. Mm-hmm. What made you go in this direction? Because you had to actually be in the Middle East to collect a lot of these stories.
No, for sure. Well, I've been studying the Middle East for the past 25 years or so, as a professor of Middle East politics. So I have spent a lot of time in the region. But the interest really came to me when I was watching the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings begin in 2011. I was following the news, like most people, from my computer screen or from TV and so forth. And I wanted to know what it felt like for people in the Arab world to go out and protest. Many of them going out and protest for the first time. People who'd lived under dictatorships, who'd lived with no political freedoms, no political rights, who faced enormous fear and enormous danger to go out into the streets and say, we've had enough. Mm-hmm. We want to choose our own leaders. We want to make our own fate. And nowhere was this more dramatic and really more dangerous than in Syria, given the nature of this really brutal dictatorship that had existed for decades. When Syrians went out into the streets, I wanted to know what it felt like for them, why they were doing it, what it meant like, and I thought there was no better way to find out what this Arab uprising mm-hmm. was all about than to go and talk to people.
You know, and the story really does start, you know, they almost talk about the Syrian conflict on March 15, 2011, mm-hmm. but to understand it, you need to go further back. The Assad family, 1982, the start of what is a brutal family dictatorship in, mm-hmm. in the way that the military taking over the Ba'ath Party. There's a lot to understand about why the people decided to come out and protest from the subsequent decades before that.
Absolutely. And that's why in writing this book, there is a lot of attention to the context, the background, to the history. Syria, like the other Arab uprisings, did not begin in a day. There's a context and a backdrop to it. And I felt like readers or anyone who wants to understand Syria needs to go back to the history and find out why people were going out to protest in the first place. So in Syria, in some ways, the story starts in 1970 when Hafez al-Assad seized power after decades of coups and instability after Syria gained its independence from France. And he built this very strong, brutal authoritarian regime. There was some support by using really economic redistribution policies for subsidies and services and that sort of thing. But there was a single party that ruled the country, even written into the Constitution that the Ba'ath Party was the ruling party and would always be so. There was this brutal and pervasive security apparatus with dozens of different security forces. And people had no rights. They couldn't speak freely. They couldn't form political parties. They couldn't form newspapers. Syrians with whom I spoke always said, you know, we grew up with the saying, the walls have ears. There was a sense that even if you talked about politics in general,
at the dinner table,
no less had the bravery to actually criticize the regime, that there could be a knock at your door and some security force would take you away, throw you in prison, and nobody would ever hear from you
again.
Yeah,
there was one instance in the book, I forgot who wrote it, but mm-hmm. talked about the idea that they made it so you wouldn't trust family members, you wouldn't trust brothers, you wouldn't trust your family, you wouldn't trust your parents, because you never know who might be a spy for the government.
Precisely. There was a sense that anybody could be a government informant, so it was better never to talk about politics. Simply keep your head down, act like you supported the regime, like you loved the leader, and just try to check out. And that's how people lived. And there were some particularly dramatic cases of real government repression that really reinforced that impression. So there, when you refer to 1982, this would come after several years of mobilization, both nonviolent by students and lawyers and syndicates, and then the Muslim Brotherhood, that was the most organized opposition group in the country, as it is in many countries in the Arab world, started carrying out violent attacks and launched something of an insurrection in the town of Hama. And the troops of Hafez al-Assad came into Hama and flattened whole sections of the city, killed up to tens of thousands, many civilians who had nothing to do with the Muslim Brotherhood, nothing to do with politics. There were cases of arbitrary arrests and killings, people who disappeared, huge, huge atrocities.
And, you know, up to this point, I mean, yes, there was building military and people knew of the dictatorship. But this was the moment where the Middle East got a good glimpse at the Assad regime. And even to this day, people call it the events. The people from the country, they say the events. That's how it's referenced. It's a major point to say Assad is as brutal as a dictator as anyone who's come before him, anyone we've known in the world.
Absolutely. These events, precisely, almost because people were almost too afraid to even name it by name, sent a warning to the entire country, maybe the entire region, for an entire generation and generations after that. This is what this regime will do to those who dare to oppose it.
Right.
We will kill, and we will kill ruthlessly. So fast forward to 2011. Hafez al-Assad, of course, dies in the year 2000. His son becomes the new president. But the security regime, the no political freedoms, the fact of no accountability, rule of law, rampant corruption, all of those problems remain. And when in the backdrop of the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, Syrians also go out into the streets. Many did so with this awareness that this is a brutal regime and we might be risking our lives,
so
but they
much,
went out anyway.
It's amazing to me. The story's amazing. The book is called We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. It really takes a look at the from the point of view of Syrians who tell the stories in this book in different essays and short entries. It's amazing, too, because Bashar Assad, he says he's going to be he's not going to be like his dad. He's going to be a moderate. He's going to be more of what we know to be a Western politician. He's going to bring reforms to the government. All of this was lip service, and it was put to the test when it came to Arab Spring. It became, you know, what kind of a leader is Assad going to be as his people are asking for reforms, asking for freedoms? And it turned out history repeats itself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He comes to power in the year 2000, says he's going to bring reform. He's Western educated. He's a doctor. He's young. He's from a different generation. And many of the Syrians that I interviewed for the book talked about how they had tremendous hope when he came to power, that he was really going to bring change. And there were various incidents in the years 2000, 2001, in which he began to show his hand, that really was not he or the others that make up the regime were in no way open for real political change. And 2011 then became the other test. And it's fascinating now because we associate Bashar al-Assad as this incredibly bloody dictator. But even at that moment when protests first began, many Syrians remember that they had a lot of hope in Bashar,
right,
that he was personally
popular. They were protesting with the idea that he was more moderate. He would listen to the people. He'd see these big protests in different cities and be able to say, okay, I'm going to change some things.
Many people really believe that. So it's important to remember also when the protests began, people were calling for reform. They weren't calling for regime change. They weren't calling to collapse the whole system. They were saying that this emergency law, which had been in place since the early 1960s, that allowed security forces to basically arrest anybody on no charge, no trial, or nothing, to have real elections, to be able to form other political parties. They were talking about making it even just a more humane form of authoritarianism. And many believed that because Bashar presented himself as somebody who listened to the people, that they would see that the people were calling for change and deliver change.
Well, obviously, let's do this. Let's take a break and we'll leave that cliffhanger because we obviously know how that turned out. But there's a very specific speech that was made by Assad early in the protest that really showed the blueprint of how he was going to treat this protest. In studio with me tonight, author and political science professor Wendy Perlman. She's the author of the new book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria, which she went to the Middle East and interviewed many Syrians to tell their story of what's been happening with the war in Syria. We'll take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation with Wendy Perlman. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Wendy Perlman. She's a political science professor at Northwestern University, and she's also the author of We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. It's a collection of essays and really first-person accounts from Syrians about the conflict in Syria. We kind of did a cliffhanger there about Assad's reaction. People were hoping for reforms. He was more of a moderate when the Arab Spring began in Syria, Syria's portion of it, and protests were happening, popping up all over the country. Assad went to the television. He made a speech. It was a big speech, and people were expecting a lot out of this speech. But what they heard was very similar from the Assad family. Essentially, if you are against me, you are against Syria, and you will die.
Yeah, absolutely. This was right at the end of the month of March 2011 when things began, and I spoke to many Syrians who talked about this huge anticipation and really hope when, for this much-anticipated speech when Bashar al-Assad speaks to the parliament. It's televised across the country. People waiting. There's this great story from a doctor in the book who says that he and other doctors and nurses all gathered in the staff room at the hospital, waiting and waiting and waiting, and then Bashar spoke, and he basically said, as you just said, it's basically, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. We will, if you want war, this is war, we will fight. And people said they watched this speech and they were completely stunned because at this point it was totally unarmed protests, young kids and young people going out into the streets, chanting slogans of reform and freedom and dignity.
Not unlike what we saw in other countries like Egypt, Tunisia.
Absolutely.
Libya. Yeah.
Not a weapon in sight, just calling for this. And he laid it out that he was going, that one, those who were calling peacefully for change were terrorists, and he was going to fight them as terrorists, and he was going to fight to the finish. And he carried out that plan. There's another interesting thing that many supporters of Bashar al-Assad from very early on chanted this slogan, and sometimes people wrote it on the walls, and many, many people quoted this to me, that they said, Assad or will burn down the country.
Yeah.
And it rhymes in Arabic. So Assad or will burn down the country. Very early on, when there was no sign of fundamentalists or ISIS or weapons or so forth, and it was a threat
either,
that has been
either
carried
you're with,
out.
You're with Assad or we will destroy, we'll flatten the entire country.
Well, and if it means that Assad is ruling over a heap of rubble with half the country, 11 million refugees and 500,000 killed, and who knows how many billions of dollars of damage, an entire country, heritage sites for hundreds of years old, destroyed forever. If that's what it takes, so this person does not
lose power
or share power, that's what he and his supporters are willing to do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, so it is just it's such a an atrocity, really.
And being present and aware of Arab Spring and everything that went into that, it was fascinating to look at this story, Syria, through the lens of what happened in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya. For some of the people who are in the book talking about watching Tunisia and saying, huh, could that happen here? Then watching Egypt and seeing Mubarak resign, saying, oh, could that happen here? And then very important to the story is Libya. And this is one that I don't think is told, is the idea that Muammar Gaddafi, the threat was he would turn the military on his people. And the United States got involved at that point, and other NATO forces, to say, you can't do that as a dictator. You cannot turn the military on your people. That's where we draw the line. That's where he was taken out. That's why that country, what happened there. That created an air of confidence for protesters that those things would not happen in Syria because they did not happen in – they weren't let to happen in the neighboring countries. But as we've seen, it hasn't worked out that way. And I think that's the ultimate betrayal slash just as an American, hard to wrap our head around the fact that – and the whole world, the whole Western world stood by to watch a dictator use military against innocent civilians.
Precisely. And there are many people in the book who say exactly that. They were watching. There's a long story from a man I interviewed who was now in Denmark who said, you know, we watched Tunisia and we thought, interesting. And then Egypt, we said, now it's getting more serious. But he said, then we watched Libya and we said, that's us. That's a dictator who will kill his people. And the West stood up and said, no, we won't allow it happen. And he said, at that point, we Syrians got the message.
A little bit of protection.
A little bit of that they will not allow the government to use unbridled, limitless force against unarmed civilians. That it won't get to that point. The world will step in and they won't allow it to happen. And the world allowed it to happen. Not just army and tanks and aerial bombardment, but chemical weapons, starvation, torture on an industrial scale. I mean, the list of crimes against humanity, no limits. And it's all been happening with the full information of the world. It's all tremendously documented. We all know it. We can see it on YouTube videos. We can see it in photographs of torture victims being smuggled from the prisons and so forth. It's all happening and we all know it, and it still continues to unfold.
There, with the several people that you were able to interview and get their stories for the book, is there a sense, and a lot of people were in neighboring Jordan and other places, they weren't in Syria when you talked to them.
Yes.
Is there a sense of betrayal? Is there a sense from these Syrians that the rest of the world has let them down?
Absolutely. So I did interviews with Syrians in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, and then in Sweden, Denmark, and Germany, and then some also in the United States. And there is a heavy, heavy sense of betrayal and abandonment. There was a sense, most people I talked to said things like, you know, we thought the West stands up for democracy and human rights, all of that rhetoric about democracy and human rights and so forth. They say, we went out to the streets unarmed, peacefully, calling for democracy, calling for human rights, and you watch us get mowed down year after year, month after month, the most atrocious of weapons. The Assad government has a full army at its disposal. It has the political, military, economic backing of Russia and Iran. There are Hezbollah fighters on the ground. There are Iranian fighters on the ground. It has all the weapons of war, and it has not hesitated to use them against civilians. It's also using them against armed rebels who, after many months, picked up arms to fight back, first defensively and then offensively, and then chaos broke loose, and now there are all sorts of groups on the ground. But the fact that states have used huge amounts of military force against civilians, men, women, children, and families, there's no disputing it.
It's somewhat,
happened, and we
all know
and
it. I want to take a break here so we can get an update on tonight's news. But I also, you know, I recognize as a political science professor, I mean, it's somewhat unprecedented, especially when you have these countries that stand for things, when you talk about the United States, for one, and the military wanting to come in, and the conflicts we've involved ourselves in the last 5 or 6 decades. They've all been along these lines, but for whatever reason, it's been a lot more complicated. One of the reasons it's gotten complicated is because the terrorist group ISIS is involved on the rebel side. We'll talk about that part. My guest tonight in studio at the big table, Wendy Perlman. She is the author of We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. It's a great book that chronicles and presents essays and first-person accounts from Syrians who witnessed what's happening in the war there. So we will take a break. We'll come back. Wendy Perlman, my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in the studio, Wendy Perlman. She is the political science professor at Northwestern University with an emphasis on Middle Eastern politics, and also the author of We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria, a new book that chronicles and gives first-person accounts, essays from Syrians who have witnessed what's happening in their country, ripped apart by the war there. And as we continue to have this conversation tonight, it is interesting because on paper it looks like a no-brainer for the West to get involved, to say you have unarmed people, you have a brutal and ruthless dictator with records, and we even see it playing out even in the last couple months. We see chemical attacks and a regime there that wants nothing but power and will do anything to squash it. It seems like a no-brainer for us to get involved, but there's this little conflict in there that obviously makes it so complicated in Western politics, and that's terrorism. ISIS took advantage of a situation. They weren't there on the ground for peaceful protests. They have come in and taken advantage of the, I guess you would say, the hole created by this war. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Talk about their involvement, because it wasn't necessarily organic.
Yeah, no, I think so. Well, so one thing is that I think the U.S. wasn't interested in getting involved even before ISIS appeared on the scene. That my understanding is that the Obama administration looked at Libya and said, that was a disaster. We got involved even with a multilateral mandate with the UN, with Russia on board, and you look at Libya and it's still a mess. So they looked at Syria and said, this is a way more complicated situation. We'd be going in against Iran's wishes, against Russia's wishes. Do we really want a kind of proxy conflict with those countries? And it's complicated. I think the Obama administration looked at it and said, can we be assured that if we were go and intervene, that it will end well? And of course, we can't be assured that action is risky.
Yeah. There was a push to say, is this what we're doing? Are we going in every country? We already in war in Afghanistan. Iraq was already happening. The American people were okay with us turning our back on Syria.
100%. And I talked to many Syrians. In fact, you know, we had the bad luck of having come in world time history after Afghanistan and after Iraq, when the U.S. and the world had no more interest in interventions, although they say our situation was quite different. You know, the invasion of Iraq was to overthrow a sitting dictator. This was a popular uprising that came from the grassroots, and people were being slaughtered. So there was a question of the will for regime change was really coming from below. It wasn't some U.S. imperialist intervention or imposition. It was coming, it would become in support of the grassroots, but still was quite complicated. So I think that the administration had the sense of action could be quite complicated and risky, and I would just respond that yes, but inaction could be complicated and
which
risky too.
Which has been a political argument. We saw many, and even in a way, we saw the President Trump in the campaign seize upon that inaction.
Yes.
To say we're going to be tough and strong against ISIS in this case, to be on Assad's side. I think when you start to bring up countries in the Middle East, there is a little bit of American, whether or not we're just indifference, or the fact that it is a complicated story, and it's one that feeds into, Pete and I were talking about right before the show, this idea that there is this America first mentality that, that came through with the campaign, and Assad is not a threat to the Americans. He's a threat to his own people, no doubt, but ISIS is a threat to Americans, and you can understand why politicians and others who are in office want to make sure that that is taken care of.
And here I think that it's helpful for the way I think about it, many Syrians, again, in the book think about it, is that ISIS is a symptom, not a cause, and that ISIS is one of the products of inaction. When the Syrian people were left sort of helpless to defend themselves against this brutal dictatorship, eventually people took up arms. And as this conflict ripped up the country and whole parts of the country sort of fell to rebel hands and the government withdrew and you had intervention by various different parties, it became something of a free-for-all. And any group with any agenda and any backer and any vision got involved and set up militias and started fighting. Mm-hmm. And Al-Qaeda was there. And then ISIS is sort of a mutation from the Al-Qaeda forces. But you basically had Al-Qaeda in Iraq looking at Syria saying this could be the next frontier. And they came in and they were able to be very, reading the book,
to be very precise in the way that the rebels, in this case, the FSA, would move forward.
Right.
And they were able to quickly move in and seize the territory that the rebels, because the military withdrew. So it wasn't that they were moving forward. They were essentially stealing. They were coming in and almost, you know, and cutting it off and being a third force to say this is ours. And then also, and this is something that I think never gets called out, but ISIS pays soldiers or pays civilians. If you want food for your family in a war-torn area, you want guns, ammunition, whatever it is, they pay better than the rebels. That is what I learned from your book.
Yeah.
And that played a big part in recruitment and the idea that they come in with resources.
Yeah. ISIS, both ISIS and the group that was formerly called Jabhat al-Nusra, which is sort of the Al-Qaeda branch, or other groups. I mean, now there are dozens, hundreds of different militias and so forth. And you think for a Syrian man who wants to fight Assad, or even if he's not even so politically motivated, needs to feed his family in a situation of utter, complete humanitarian collapse, no jobs, no food, no basic medical care, someone might join and become a fighter as a kind of have a salary and would probably go with the highest bidder to be able to provide for his family and so forth. So there are lots of different motivations for why people might pick up arms or why they might join one group or another that are much more complicated than simply believing the idea.
I wonder, you know, obviously we don't have a crystal ball to see how this kind of works out because so many different factions have moved in and taken the place almost of the uprising. The people who, the innocent people who just wanted a voice, they're not there anymore. The rebels have become vested interests for other parties. Let's talk about the Syrian people.
Yeah.
People who don't want to be involved in the conflict, yet the military comes in and carpet bombs all of the of the block that they live in. And they have to make terrible choices to say either I fight with ISIS or I leave my homeland. Many have chosen to leave. We have seen this story over and over again, captured by terrible images we've seen of children drowning, trying to cross. Talk about that, because that has become a humanitarian crisis that's spoken by leaders, it's used in campaigns. But the idea that most of the Syrian people, millions of people, have said, this, we can't stay here.
Yeah, I mean, the people estimate the pre-war Syrian population of 22 or 23 million. About 11 million have been displaced. 6 million or so are internally displaced. So they've been forced to flee their homes, but they're living elsewhere still in Syria. About 5 million are refugees in the border countries, mostly Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. About 1 million or so have moved on to Europe. And then there are others who've gotten asylum in other countries in North America and so forth. So it's an unbelievably difficult choice for people to leave the only homes they've ever known, their neighborhoods, all of their worldly belongings. And families are also separated. Most of Syrian families now are scattered across countries. The people I've interviewed, if there's someone in the Middle East, probably have some family still in Syria, some family who've made it into Europe. I know husbands and wives who are separated, children and parents who are separated. So for people to leave, and especially leave loved ones, is tremendously heart-wrenching. And then people get to wherever they've sought refuge. And there's a whole slew of new, tremendously, overwhelmingly difficult challenges. How people find work. People in many of the border countries especially are working in terribly exploitative conditions for basically no wages, long hours, no recourse and no law to protect them, many working informally, 15 hours a day in sweatshops. There's a huge problem of child labor, children who are working in factories or in fields and so forth. Sometimes families are depending upon the wages that children earn. So in terms of what some people call this lost generation of Syrian kids who aren't going to school because they're working to support mm-hmm. their families, people living in tents, under bridges, people who've lost everything and continue to lose. So there's a full range. I mean, not everyone is so destitute. It's a diverse society. People of different classes and backgrounds. And that is all just to look at the material and security situation, the mental anguish of trauma, have witnessed so much violence, who've lost loved ones, who've been tortured, who've been raped. I mean, the amount of trauma is just unbelievable.
It's amazing to me, you know, because you have so many different people who mm-hmm. contributed, who you were able to catch up to and interview and tell their story. Mm-hmm. Amazing, page after page yeah. of people. Well, I was in prison.
Yeah,
I was taken from my family because they suspected me to be a right. protester. All rape and yeah. everything down the line, where it really paints a picture that you have to leave. You can't be in a situation where it's not just sort of like, I think I'm going to move to Greece. This is life and death. And a lot of times you talked about separating people. They're separated before they even make the choice to leave. This is unfathomable for Americans. When you talk to the Syrians who are in Jordan, in Lebanon, and in the border mm-hmm. countries where you did most of the interviews, mm-hmm. are they aware of the media picture, the idea that this is not only a humanitarian crisis, but a crisis of immigration for countries, and that the Syrian people are a burden and are, in some cases, politicians say, are dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a tremendous amount of awareness. People follow the news. They live on the news. People, you know, are on their cell phones following updates and are tremendously well informed. So I think I came across a lot of almost maybe more aware of a lot of American political rhetoric than some Americans are. So they're very much aware, and it just adds layers of insult onto injury that people who've suffered so much, and not just suffered, but people who've been so brave in calling for what we claim as our own values and ideals, so that American politicians might say, these people hate us, they hate our freedoms, when most Americans haven't, I can say for myself, I have never made many sacrifices for the freedoms I enjoy as an American.
Right.
I never fought for it. Right. I never risked life for it. I never went to prison for my right to vote. Many of us don't even exercise our right to vote. Syrians risked their lives for it, and some gave their lives for the basic freedoms that many of us take for granted. So that whole history of that courage of fighting for freedom would be forgotten. And now people would say and even suggest, Syrian refugees hate us for our freedom? I mean, it's the yeah. ironies upon ironies, and it's really a cruel slander in many ways. So I would hope Americans could appreciate and respect more of what Syrians have been through, to try to understand the Syrian experience through Syrian eyes. And I think they would really walk away with tremendous respect, not fear, not necessarily pity, but respect for who Syrians are and what they've suffered.
When you go back and you go back to March 15, 2011, mm-hmm. and the choice is made to gather on the square to, mm-hmm. and you talk to the different Syrian people in the book, and you think about that what they were protesting was humanitarian issues, the idea of no rights, the way they're treated, the way that their picked up and thrown in jail if just on suspicion of anything. Even we can get into the economic way that Assad runs a country, and it's all for them and none for the people. All the things that are just, I mean, I hate to use the term red line, a red line for us in America.
Yes.
We would never accept these things. When you talk to them, do they hold their head high when they think of the experience of speaking out and what's happened to them in a very short time, in 6 years? People lost their country. They lost their families. They didn't get the support of the Western world. This isn't your fairy tale story of the Revolutionary War or a country fighting for their freedom with a flag on the top and they won. This is the nightmare scenario for someone who decided, I'm mad as hell and I can't take it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing to think about is that a lot of people, Syrians, really are still fighting. I mean, there are even people on the ground that continue with all sorts of nonviolent and civic engagement. There are these parts of the country from which the government has withdrawn and that's fallen under rebel hands. Sometimes they have local councils in which members of the community are governing, and they even have elections. There are development projects. There are women's sewing projects and initiatives and bakeries and schools and all sorts of ways in which some Syrians, in spite of so much suffering and so much destruction, are still working. They're still working on the ground in Syria, even under the bombs, with free radio stations and newspapers. I mean, it's tremendously inspiring. And in other countries, in all sorts of activities for relief and development and training and rebuilding and psychosocial support. So people are continuing to work, which is tremendously inspiring. I think there's otherwise a range. Some people look back and say, these were the greatest moments. And if I've lost everything, at least I can say, as a dignified human being, I went out and I said, no, I stood up for my rights. And some people look at that with a tremendous pride to this day. And I still get goosebumps when I think about it. And I always ask myself, would I have had the guts to do what they did? So I think a lot of people look back with pride. But other people look at what the country has become and they say, with something between guilt and regret or just tremendous pain, did we do the right thing? Yes, should we have lived like slaves or lived unfree forever because it was better than the death and the destruction? And you think about that, it's a choice that no nation should ever have to make. You live either dictatorship or complete slaughter. You think, oh, should Syrians have think, oh, so which one should they have chosen, dictatorship or complete slaughter? The question is, where is the world that abandoned any other country to have to choose between those two things, that there's not a third way of some path towards political transition, some path to allow people to choose their own leaders, some path to rule of law and to basic civil and human rights? It's a tragedy for us all that Syrians have wound up with those two choices.
The book is called We Crossed the Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. It's a fantastic book. Wendy Perlman is the author. She's also a political science professor at Northwestern here in Chicago. Wendy, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate you first collecting the stories for this book, putting them together, and also sitting down and talking to us at the big table. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.